Hi, folks. This is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today, for you anyway, it is April the 24th, 2025, and this is episode 3,660 of the Survival Podcast. It's an expert council Q&A show. And even though I'm not really back here in the saddle, so to say, until Monday, and back at my regularly scheduled program, for you, we have returned to regular scheduled programming. I cut this show on Monday of this week in advance for you guys. I originally, as I said on Monday, intended to do only one rewind, and then reality hit me in the face on Monday morning, like, dude, if you're going to get everything here ready for your wife before you leave so her life is easy, which is like really what you absolutely better do, then you're not going to do that. So what I did is Monday I cut the new show and this show for you, and then we had a couple rewinds, and then tomorrow we'll have a flashback, but that is regularly scheduled progress. So everything's back to normal. What do we got going on this week, though, with the EC? Great lineup. Some of our new folks, some of our old folks. Lots of diversity today. We're going to lead off not with Ron Paul. Chris Rossini was off this week, and I said, hey, I'm going to be gone, too. Just take it off. So we have Carrie Brown, who's picked up on something I said a couple times during some of his recent segments. My affinity for Black Locust. He's going to talk to you about the Black Locust and the very limited window you have for foraging, which is right about now. My trees are in full flower and they're already beginning to ebb out where the blossoms aren't that great anymore. But if you're north of me at all, which most of you are, in most of the native Black Locust range, they are just beginning to flower right now. And even that's a little bit early for the season, according to Carrie. And I tend to agree, though. It's been a while since I spent time in the Northeast, which is where I learned about this tree when I was a little kid. Next up, Matt Sersley will talk about the home office deduction. I'm going to actually throw some gas on that fire and tell you that there are very few CPAs that really know how to maximize this deduction at this point. I am blessed to have one. And if you have a fairly expensive home and you have a fairly large amount of space, this can be a much bigger deduction than you might think. John Pugliano will talk about more about the media's lies on the economy, why you should ignore it, and what you should be doing instead. Old Doc Bones, you know, we're going to talk about some gun stuff today with Mike Molito from Good Shepherd Training, but Doc Bones is going to talk about bullets on the wrong end. When you get hit, well, not necessarily you, but if you're acting as the survival medic in a grid-down scenario and somebody's got a gunshot wound, what do? You just let them die? Or is there anything you can do even as somewhat of a partially trained layman? There are some things you can do. Doc Mullins will talk about that. Nick Ferguson will talk about timing your planting of nut seeds for tree propagation. I put Nick Nuts in the short brief for myself today. Nick is nuts. Anyway, Mike Molito, like I said, he's going to be talking about guns as well. He's talking about improving your skills for concealed carry, and I would really say carry. Like, there are places where you can open carry. I tend not to, but you can here in Texas now, and I think most of what he says will apply to it either way, though I am an advocate for concealing the fact that you're carrying in most situations, not because I don't want to offend anybody, not because we don't have a right to do it or whatever, because generally speaking, if you don't know I'm armed, tactically, that tends to be an advantage in a bad situation for me. This is why actually a long time ago, before we had all the ridiculous levels of gun regulations in this country, there were laws where it was completely okay for you to open carry, but not for you to carry concealed. The idea being that the person hiding the gun has something to hide. I don't agree. I think that there's a real tactical advantage if there's a bad guy around. That I'm not like, I'm the bad guy and I'm going to go shoot this place up. And like, that dude has a gun. Guess who I'm shooting first? You see what I mean? Anyway, Mike does a great job on this. And I'm going to talk about something I was supposed to talk about last week in my kickoff show for the week. Not this week, the week before, the value of labor. Somehow that got left out of the variety show I did last week. I want to talk about what makes labor valuable and why the insistent need by the left, the Democrats, call them what liberals, whatever you want to try to equalize labor is absolutely stupid on its face. It doesn't make any sense, and it defies all laws of economics. And the hour that you spend doing something, the hour that somebody else spends doing something are not equal. even if you're doing mostly the same thing, but when you're doing different things, it's really magnified. And we're going to talk a little bit about something we talk about in permaculture, but applied to labor, gilding. And the fact that gilding, today we call it unions, right? The fact that this even exists in the first place is an acknowledgement that labor is not equally apportioned in value. I think this will be a good one for you because we're going to be doing a lot about business going forward, and you need to understand this fundamental as an entrepreneur. Whether you're paying for labor in a contract relationship, a direct employment relationship, it doesn't really matter, or even negotiating with suppliers, understanding labor's value helps you understand services' value as well. So this will be a good one. With that, just remind you real quick, you can always help us out by doing your online shopping where tspaz.com. We've had some great items of the day this last couple weeks. They're all in the show notes for you today. And of course, Laws of Life is coming out on May the 12th, which, by the way, it's our anniversary. Dorothy and I will be married for 24 years. And this year we have been together for 29. So we're 1 year shy of our silver anniversary on the launch of the book. It just worked out that way. It wasn't planned, but it's kind of cool. The ambassador program by now is definitely closed. There was one position left on Monday. So what you could still do is get by and fill out the form just to get the notice so that you can participate in picking up a copy or several on the drop week and help us hit some bestseller lists on Amazon. I'd love to add to my CV a best-selling author instead of just author. With that, let's go ahead and drop into our first segment, Carrie Brown on Foraging the Black Locust.
Hey, TSP community. Carrie here with Strong Roots Resources, and we've got another flowering tree with edible buds and edible flowers. I kind of wanted to get this one out to you as early as possible because it's not a very long window that these flowers are edible. And in this case, I'm talking about the black locust. Now, normally, based off of my charting from last year, these normally came into bloom. I'm checking my calendar here. More like the last week of April. So they're early. We've had a lot of rain. We had unseasonably warm weather a couple of weeks ago, so everything's kind of waking up early here in East Tennessee. But the black locust has these beautiful little flowers, and you'll find them initially kind of, you know, they'll be in their bud stage. They'll still be closed, and you can eat them in that stage, but it's better if you wait. When you eat them in that younger stage, they kind of taste like a pea. They taste like a less flavorful sugar snap pea. But if you wait until they've actually opened up, that's when the sugars come in, and these are really, really good. They're really delicate flowers, though, so normally what tends to happen is about the time that they open up, we'll have one of those springtime storms come through, and it knocks the flowers off, and you've kind of lost your chance. So keep an eye out for your black locusts. They're real standout trees. Their leaf pattern is very distinctive, so they're pretty easy to pick out. And I'm also going to attach a short Instagram clip that I put up recently where I show one of these on our property that I found ready to be foraged. So keep an eye out for those. It's a very short window. They're very tasty. They dress up a salad wonderfully. And it's just one of those I feel like is maybe a little bit overlooked and undervalued. So keep an eye out on your black locust trees. A lot of times that even though, you know, they'll be tall and difficult to access the flowers. A lot of times you'll see them kind of growing sideways off of embankments and even riverbanks. And those limbs tend to be a little bit easier to get a hold of and try them out. So thanks for listening. Give me a holler if I can help you with any of your foraging or natural land study needs. And we'll talk to you guys next time.
So the video that Carrie sent me, when I clicked on the link, it went to his Instagram, which is for followers only, and I didn't realize I wasn't following him. His whole account is locked. Unless you're following him, you can't see what he posts. Carrie, don't hate money. That is not how to run an Instagram account attached to your business. Anyway, I did send him an email and said, you should either change that or put the video somewhere else so I can send people to. I had to do this episode Monday, and I had to get it done, so I went ahead and did it. Right now, as I'm speaking in live voice, The link to the Instagram is there, and you can wait for him to approve you if you're not a follower already, and you should totally follow him. If he sends me an alternative link, I will change it as long as that happens in the next, like, day or two. Once Tuesday or Wednesday morning hits, I am leaving on a jet plane, and I'm out. So if that link is there, that's what there is for now. Moving on, let's hear from Matt Sersley on the home office deduction.
Hey, TSP crew, this is Matthew Sersley, here to talk with you about how to save money. I'm with AccuristTaxAdvice.com. Recently, I talked about my very favorite way to save money on taxes, which is hiring your kids. Today, I'm going to talk about my second favorite way to save money on taxes. And it's weird because it's not going to save you that much money most of the time, but it opens up a lot of other things that will save you money. And that is having a home office or a home workspace. Now, if you file your taxes, nothing on your tax form is going to say home office. It's going to say business use of home. That's what the form is you file. Now, you have to go through some hoops to get this. You need a space, a dedicated space in your home that is used exclusively for the business. That means if you got a spare room, but your in-laws stay there two nights a year, that is not exclusive use. You get to claim that 0 days per year. But if you can set aside a space, and it does not have to be a whole room, it can be this 5x7 area of this room. You've got a home office. Home office lets you write off a percentage of your property taxes, of your mortgage interest, of your insurance payments, of your utility payments, of general repairs to the house. In certain situations, even things like landscaping costs, or if you have a housekeeper come in and clean, you may get to deduct a proportion of that. And this is a great way to claim some of these things you can't otherwise claim. Normally, you have to itemize to claim that interest deduction on your mortgage. And with current standard deductions, very few people itemize. Well, this way, maybe you can claim 10 or 15% of that, not directly, but as part of the home office exemption. Similarly, if you have a cap for the SALT, the state and local taxes, of $10,000 because of the Trump tax cuts, well, the taxes you write off as part of your property taxes through your office are not part of that $10,000 cap. So it's a way to get at least some of that money back into your pocket. But for a lot of people, you know, if you've got, you know, a 10 by 10 area, maybe it's only a $500, maybe a $1,000 write-off, you're saving $200-$300. Who really cares? And isn't it a big risk anyway? It did used to be a risk. It's really not today. It's not a red flag. The IRS, especially after COVID, has basically said, oh yeah, people have home offices now. And it's really not any sort of a special red flag. You know, you better be able to prove it. If you get audited, if you get letters from the IRS, they're going to want to see proof, but it's not a red flag. But is it worth it for a couple hundred bucks? Well, first of all, sometimes it's more than a couple hundred bucks. Run the numbers on it. I've had several clients who have saved thousands of dollars a year in taxes because of what's going on. You know, if you're lucky enough to be like Jack Spirko and have a big workshop that you can use for your business, that might be another way to save a whole lot of money on taxes. Because you can claim a lot more square footage, so you get a whole lot more savings. Maybe you have multiple offices in the home and you can claim them. If you build a structure outside the home, you can claim that except. But the thing I really like, and this is the trick I really like, is it opens up a lot more mileage deductions for you. So currently the IRS says the first time you drive to your office, well, let me restate that. The first time you travel to your office, that doesn't count. That's your commute. You can't write that off. And whenever you travel from your office home, the last time for the day, that's your regular commute. You can't write that off. But any other driving you do for your business during the day, you can write that off by the mileage. And this year in 2025, that's 70 cents per mile. It can add up really quickly. Well, what if your commute is not getting in your car and driving 20 miles away? What if your commute is putting on your slippers and walking across the home to your home office? Check your email, send out a couple emails, work 15, 20 minutes, and then when you drive to your separate workplace, that's not your commute anymore. Now that 20 miles is business travel. You get to write off that 20 miles. That's $14 of write-off. When you drive home, as long as you drive to your home office, do a little bit of work there, and then go back into your home from your home office, that's another $14 write-off. So you get a $28 per day write-off by doing this. If you go into work every day, it's like $140 a week. It's practically $1,000 per month or $12,000 of a write-off for the whole year. Most people are going to save $3,000 in taxes on that. But you can't do any of that without the home office. So no, we don't care about the one or the two or the $300, but I think you care about that $3,000. It also opens you up to do a lot of other trips and make them business trips. This is particularly advantageous if you live kind of in the boonies. So let's say you're going to go into town on a date with your wife. Well, if you got to run by the hardware store to get something for your business or run by Office Depot or something like that, now that mileage is business mileage. Now, don't be greedy. If it's 20 miles to that store and then 10 miles to where the date is, don't write off the 30 miles. But write off the 20 miles. You're going to do the driving anyway. This way you save some money on taxes. There's a couple of other tricks involving the home office kind of like this that it opens up other things you can do. It opens up potentially other deductions you can take as a business expense, because now you've got an office. If maybe you didn't even have an office, if you're a solopreneur, weekend warrior, keyboard warrior, there are things you can't deduct as easily as if you have an office. Please, if you qualify, you should absolutely be claiming the home office deduction. Even if it's only 5x6, 5x7, it really can add up. Well, that's all for this week. Please reach out to me at agoristtaxadvice.com/TSP. I've got a free report there that gives you over 60 different business deduction ideas to get your mind flowing and get you thinking about how much money you can really save on different things. Hope to help you out. Thank you.
So the additional things that Matt added, like how this impacts your mileage deduction, completely agree with. However, I'm going to say that if you have a significant business income and you live in a home that's, couple thousand square foot or even 1,600-1,700 square foot or more, and you have a significant expense in maintaining that home, which you probably would, and you're only getting a couple hundred dollars off your taxes for your home office deduction, you might need to look for a new CPA or inform your CPA to do a little bit better with backfeeding these additional expenses. There is a litany of additional expenses on your home that can be backfed into the home office deduction based on the square footage compared to the total square footage under the home. Now, I think Matt's heard me mention how good the home office deduction is for me, and because of maybe some misunderstanding about how much can be backfed, he thinks it's because I got a 1,600 square foot shop that I use for a workshop, and I can say that it's part of the business. I don't touch that in the home office deduction. There's way too much ability for an auditor to say, that's not 100% for your business, Mr. Spierko. However, the two rooms inside the home, that's one's my office and one is Dorothy's office, there is no way to say they're not 100% for the business. If you came here and looked at them, about the only thing that happens here is two really kind of disorganized people run their office out of here. So we get a fantastic deduction because almost every single expense on the home can be backfed and then relatively deducted compared to the percentage of square footage under roof of the home. And that means things like your homeowner's insurance. It means a lot of things that even before the salt cap deduction weren't deductible become deductible. It's your utilities, including your electric bill, which if you live in Texas is probably pretty damn high in the summertime, etc. So, and then I want to say one other thing. When Matt says something like, well, if your in-laws sleep there two nights out of the week, you can't do it, he's giving you a lawyer's explanation. The letter of the law, the letter of the code, exactly the way it's supposed to be. Are you going to take pictures of it and send that in with your tax return? What I'm going to tell you is you should make damn sure that anybody looking at the area you have designated as a home office expense would look at that and see a home office. And look at it and see nothing in it that wouldn't be typically found if you rented an office space and you drove to your office every day, like I did when we lived in Arkansas and I wasn't able to do a home office expense, I had office rent, okay? If you had that, would what's there be reasonably in your home office? You know, if you got a bunch of shit for kids to play with and all, then don't. And the other thing is, you're not going to get, like, an audit and say, we're coming to your house in 15 seconds, right? If you were ever audited, you might want to maybe move a few things around. That's all I'm saying. I'm just saying, if I let somebody sleep on the floor of my office, it's still my office. And the way I would rationalize that is there's been times when I was working really, really hard, and I had an office, and it got to where I worked so late and had to be in so early, I slept in my office, at my work. Did that make it not an office because I slept there? No. So you have to be careful with that, and that's why as a lawyer, he's going to give you a letter of the law. But I'm going to tell you, if I had let somebody sleep on the floor of my office, and I didn't, Mr. IRS agent, then I probably would still take the deduction. I'm just saying. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and take another one. And this one from John Pugliano in Investing Despite the Media's Lies.
Hello, TSP. Hey, there's a lot of volatility in the stock market. It looks like perhaps we've reached capitulation once some of the reality is setting in. A lot of Trump's tariff policies are more negotiating tactics than long-lasting retaliatory tariffs. In any case, I don't want to get into all that. I do want to say this. And if you're a long-term listener of the Wellsteading podcast, you know I'm a big promoter of basically ignoring the media. And that's not only the mainstream media, but the alternative media as well. You know, in my opinion, the media is not there to inform you. They're simply there to either generate viewership so they can charge more for advertising, or they're trying to promote some type of underlying agenda. In any case, if there was ever a time not to believe the media, it's right now. Just two quick examples, and these deal with my realm of, you know, the economy. There's obviously a lot of other examples, but specifically towards the economy and the negative bias towards the United States economy. Look what's recently been said about U.S. Treasury interest rates and specifically the 10-year Treasury. When the yield on the 10-year Treasury dropped down to about 4.25%, all over the mainstream media and even the alternative media, the story was that Trump is purposely trying to create a recession and crash the economy so that he can get lower interest rates. About a week and a half later, when rates went back to where they had previously been, at about 4.5%, the media narrative suddenly became that global finance had lost faith in the U.S. dollar and that no one was buying our debt and there was going to be, you know, a death spiral for U.S. currency. None of that's true. If you simply look at the fluctuations of the 10-year Treasury, they've been all over the map since the post-pandemic, and in my opinion, mostly because Biden and Janet Yellen added way too much debt and federal spending even after the economy had stabilized. You know, with things like Build Back Better and the Inflation Reduction Act and all the other unnecessary debt that they ran up between 2021 and really well into 2024. In any case, there's nothing wrong with the U.S. Treasury market right now. The second big story, and this is always a reoccurring theme, but just recently, China has devalued its yuan currency. And again, this is a common theme with them. They've been doing it for 20 years or more. But the story in the media is, hey, the Chinese are so smart. They're getting around Trump's tariffs by reducing the value of their currency. So in effect, they're mitigating the effects of the tariffs. Well, lo and behold, in the last, you know, 10 days or so, the U.S. dollar has come off its post-election highs from Trump getting elected. And while the yuan is still down significantly, you know, from the U.S. dollar, what has risen is the euro. So the euro is up about 10 to 12% from where it had been. Now, on a historical level, over the last 20 years, it's still significantly below its average. But what I want to point out here is that the media coverage is not what they said about devaluation of the yuan, right? The media story could be that Trump effectively just raised the cost of European imports by 10 or 12% without ever initiating a tariff. Or the corollary that American products imported into Europe would be 10 to 12% less, again, without Trump having to do any negotiations. That would be the story if you took it from what the media always says about China. But in this case, what did they say? Well, of course, they continued their narrative that the U.S. economy is falling apart, the dollar's losing value, it's not going to be the reserve currency, yada, yada, yada. It's never ending, and it's not just negative Trump. Every time you hear them criticize Trump, just throw in the United States of America, because that's ultimately what they're trying to talk down. They're trying to talk down the strength and resilience of the United States economy. Well, hey, that's just my opinion. If you like what I say, you might want to follow me over at Investable Wealth or the Wealth Steading Podcast. Until next time, this is John Pugliano wishing you best returns.
Great stuff from John. As always, I definitely recommend you subscribe to his podcast. It is an exceptional podcast. Next up today, though, we're going to hear about Nutty Nick. Yep, Nutty Nick. Nick Ferguson is going to answer a question here for a listener on when to start nut tree seeds for plant propagation. He's running a little backyard nursery, which I think is a great side hustle.
Hey there, Nick Ferguson here with another expert counsel answer. This time for Nick T. in Indiana. My question is for expert counsel member Nick Ferguson. When is the best time to plant nursery nut seeds, chestnut, hazelnut, pecan, hickory, into air-prune boxes? I have used my web design background to start a small online backyard nursery side hustle in West Central Indiana on the border of zones 5B, 6A. I have had success in the fall with burying plastic buckets with drainage holes in the ground filled with nut seeds and moist sand. I then dig up the buckets at the beginning of spring and find that the seeds have germinated on nature's timing and are ready for planting. I have four little kids and a full-time job, so I'm trying to streamline things as much as possible. Can I save time and just plant the nut seeds straight in the air prune boxes outside in the fall as long as I protect them from rodents with hardware cloth on top? Is there a risk of seeds freezing or drying out in the air prune boxes over the winter? Should I cover the planted air prune boxes with straw wood chips for insulation and then remove in spring? Thank you, Jack, you jerk. I decided to start this nursery after hearing podcast number 1481 a couple of years ago. Love the way you're thinking, man. One of the first things that came to mind for me was the idea of an excavated in-ground area. So if you can cut out an area like maybe like 8 inches deep or so to get those air prune pots just a little bit nestled into the ground, and lay down your weed barrier fabric and hardware cloth, whatever you're using, and then whatever you're using to act as a spacer to get them up off the ground just a little bit for that air movement, that would be great, and that would give you a spot where you could kind of nestle them in the ground. I mean, if you could get them a foot in the ground, that'd be fantastic, and that would protect them from a lot of cold damage and keep them moist, and also would provide plenty of drainage because they would just be sitting up off of the ground and everything could drain out at the bottom. But at bare minimum, I would pick a spot where you can lay down like maybe a quarter inch mesh hardware cloth with weed barrier fabric over the top to give you a nice spot to set things up just on top of the ground. And then you cover the top of the pots with the same hardware cloth to protect them from, you know, attack from the top from those rodents. And then, you know, bump up to them. You line the perimeter of the air pots with straw bales and then fill in the top with loose straw fill or fallen leaves to insulate the top and protect them from both drying out too much and as a little bit of insulation. Either one of those should work pretty well for you. I'm going to try and keep this answer punchy and to the point, so I'll do some bullet points for you. The best time to plant. Plant nursery nut seeds, chestnut, hazelnut, pecan, hickory, in air prune boxes in fall, late September, early November for natural cold stratification. Rodent protection, you want to cover them and protect them with quarter inch hardware cloth. You want to securely fasten it, and that should protect the seeds from rodents like squirrels and mice. Prevent freezing, drying out. I would use a moisture retentive, well draining medium like peat, sand, compost mixed together. You want to have some compost in there to help hold a little bit of extra moisture. You want to water them thoroughly after planting, and you want to definitely make sure that you're going out there and monitoring the moisture levels during dry winter spells. Place the boxes in a sheltered spot. A north-facing wall would actually be really good because that's going to minimize your temperature swings, because you want to keep them cool. You don't want them warming up a whole bunch. Insulation. Apply at least 4 to 6 inches minimum of straw, wood chips, or fallen leaves over the boxes for insulation and moisture retention. Remove that gradually in early spring, mid-March to early April. If you're using leaves, go double thickness because they're going to compress. They're going to fall a lot. Streamlining tips. I would group boxes together for easier watering and mulching. Check the boxes monthly in winter for proper moisture levels. Use larger air prune boxes if you have them to reduce container management. And then your risk management. Ensure good drainage to prevent rot. You don't want them sitting directly on the ground, or if you have, let's say, heavy clay soils, you don't want to basically dig a bathtub and then set them all in there and not realize that it's going to retain all that water, and then half of the bottom of the air prune pots are just full of water. Mulch adequately to protect against rare extreme cold. You know, if it's going to be dropping to like negative 20 or below, you get one of those great Arctic vortexes or whatever. Great question. Keep them coming, guys. Sorry I haven't been on the EC segments lately. I've been really busy with tree shipping season, and I've been doing some consulting. I'm actually currently on the road. If you notice a difference in the audio, I'm recording this on my laptop's garbage internal microphone, so hopefully this doesn't sound completely awful. We'll be shipping the last of the trees and putting the last of our stock up on clearance when I get home from this trip. So if you have ordered and you want some more, or if you forgot about it this winter and are just now hearing about it, we will still have a little bit of things available. A bunch of things are sold out, but we do have a couple bundles of a few of those things left over. So head over to rareplantstore.com to see what we have up. I hope to have the store updated with the clearance items on the 23rd or 24th after I have a day to recover from all of this driving. I'm Nick Ferguson. Do good things.
Great advice from Nick, as always. Next up, we got Doc Bones talking about ballistics, and not the way I usually talk about ballistics, like here's the sectional density, and that has a lot to do with has everything to do with the projectile's ability to fly, and therefore here's how that affects at this muzzle velocity, your drop over, let's say, 300 meters versus something. No. And you are on the other end, and you got a hole in you now, and someone's got to take care of you, and they can't just run you to the doctor because we're in a grid down scenario. And remember, always when we talk about like survival medicine, grid down scenarios and all, Doc comes at this for teaching purposes with, you know, an apocalyptic event has occurred, and there is no higher level of care. And that's because then you're prepared for anything. That can exist for all practicality, even if there is a higher level of care. Let's say a day away. A day is plenty of time to die. An hour is plenty of time to die. A few minutes is plenty of time to die. So you may have this scenario, for instance, let's say that you were out hunting in a very remote area and there was a hunting accident, right? Or let's say that you had your little cabin in the woods and you and a couple friends are out there hanging out and all, and some bad guy shot one of y'all and you can't get to help quickly. All of that would apply to everything he's about to tell you, except some of the longer-term care. Hopefully, by then, you would have help. But this is important stuff for everybody.
Hi, Joe Walton, MD here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net, co-author of the Book Excellence Award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and designer of quality medical kits at store.doomandbloom.net. Lately, I've been talking about illnesses like hepatitis and prostate cancer, but today I want to talk about something every survival medic must be ready to face in times of trouble. That's the effects of ballistic trauma. Ballistics is a science that deals with the launching, flight, behavior, and effects of projectiles. A projectile can include anything that can be launched by physical or mechanical means, such as a rock, a spear, bullet, arrow, cruise missile, heck, even a baseball. For today's purpose, we're going to discuss basics of ballistic trauma as caused by small arms fire. Knowledge of the trauma caused by bullets is not only useful in extreme survival scenarios or on the battlefield, but also for hunters and those in law enforcement. It's also important for the family medic to understand the type of injury they may be called upon to treat off the grid, or even, God forbid, in normal times. High-velocity projectile damages caused by a bullet can be, as you might imagine, much greater than low-velocity damage to the same area caused by, say, a knife or an arrow wound. This damage depends on the amount of energy the projectile possesses due to its motion. In physics, this is referred to as kinetic energy. It actually follows a formula. Kinetic energy equals the mass of the projectile times its velocity squared, divided by 2. If you remember your math, the number squared is a number multiplied by itself. For example, 2 squared is 2 times 2 is 4. Because of this, you can see from the kinetic energy formula that the velocity or speed of the projectile is more important in the causing of damage than its weight or mass. That's why an AR-15 does more damage than a typical handgun, even though the weight of the round is less. It travels that much faster, then you square that in the equation. It's a big difference. So the bullet has left the barrel of the firearm is on its way to a human body. As the projectile strikes and passes through, it decelerates, transferring all of this kinetic energy to living tissue. The result is a traumatic wound caused by several methods. Let's talk about them. First, permanent cavitation. This is the path that's permanently left by the projectile as it passes through. Essentially, this is the bullet hole and the channel caused by its traverse through the body. Then there's temporary cavitation. This is a wider shock wave caused by all that kinetic energy that affects tissue not directly in the path of the bullet, but crushes organs beyond the actual path of the bullet. All that energy has to dissipate. As the bullet decelerates, it meets resistance, that is, its victim. If you watch a demo of any firearm tested on ballistic gel, you'll see the actual path, the permanent cavitation, and then a wider shock wave, the temporary cavitation, which affects much more of an area. Although various organs have differing elasticities, the shock wave surpasses the tissue's ability to absorb the energy involved, and sometimes causing severe damage to it. Now, there are other ways that a bullet causes damage, and one is deformation. As a bullet enters the body, it may deform, increasing its diameter and the cavity that it causes passing through, often at the expense of penetration depth. Hollow point bullets are an example of projectiles that are meant to deform or mushroom on impact as they travel through the body. And then there's yaw. Yaw refers to the rotation of the nose of the bullet away from the line of flight as it travels. A short, high-velocity round begins to yaw more severely over time and can even turn head over heels upon entering tissue, if it starts far enough away. This causes a larger temporary cavitation and more tissue to be violently displaced and damaged. And finally, let's talk about fragmentation. Bullets may fragment as they travel through the body. This causes multiple cavitation channels, both permanent and temporary. Some bullets are specifically designed to fragment for this very purpose. Imagine 20 or 30 cavitation channels. Compounding the damage caused by all the forces that I just mentioned, the medic is additionally confronted with uncertainty as to whether an exit wound exists and where it might be. Besides generally being larger than entry wounds, exit wounds are variable in their locations and don't always follow a straight path. This depends on the position the victim was in when shot and also the structures that were impacted when the bullet entered the body. The bullet hits a bone, for example, it can cause it to fracture and then shatter or continue at unexpected angles throughout the rest of the body. If a person is crouching, for example, when struck in the upper chest, the exit wound might be located as far away as the lower back or even the rear end. In future segments, I'll talk about dealing with the consequences of ballistic trauma in disaster settings. This is Joe Alton, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, learn more about more than 200 off-grid medical topics in the award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook and get your family medically prepared with quality kits and individual supplies from our entire line at store.doomandbloom.net. You'll be glad you did.
All right, so now we just discussed potentially being on the receiving end of a bullet. Well, many of us in this audience, I would say probably at least more than half, are people that carry a gun, if not all the time, on a regular basis or in certain scenarios. And we don't do that because we think we're cool because we have a gun. We do that for the awful point in time, the way we may be called upon to use that gun to defend our life or the life of another innocent in a tragic situation. And instead of being the one receiving it, hopefully we're the one delivering it. If that is going to happen, then competence is incredibly important, obviously. If you're going to walk around with an implement capable of causing death, you want to be absolutely competent with it, because not only may that be necessary to end the threat, but it's also necessary to avoid, at all possible cost, injuring an innocent bystander. Right, and one of the best ways to not have bullets going everywhere is to have them all going to the bad guy. Now, you can get over penetration and all, but this is a pretty tried and true scenario. When someone effectively takes the bad guy out, generally, that's it. It's kind of over. But it's not as easy as you might think. It's not like the movies. You see these people get hit by a bullet in movies and they go blowing backwards. That doesn't happen. That doesn't happen with a 12-gauge slug. It damn sure doesn't happen with a 38 special. And a lot of times when in these scenarios where someone is in a situation where lethal force is necessary, it is a high-stress situation, obviously, and that person isn't likely to just lay down because you put one in them. Follow-up shooting is important. Firing until the threat is stopped is important. And there's a lot more to it than that. And a big part of it is being well-regulated. And well-regulated doesn't mean what the left wants it to mean when they talk about the Second Amendment. What does it mean? Mike will tell all to you that and a bunch more in this next segment.
What is going on, TSP? Michael here from Gunfighter Life Podcast to answer your gun and gun-related questions. Since I did not get any queries this week, but Jack asked for expert counsel content, I thought I would do a brief segment. For all of you out there that take the right to bear arms seriously on a daily basis. You carry, conceal carry, walk softly and carry a big stick, whatever vernacular you want to use. You conceal carry or you're conceal carry curious. I'm going to talk about some core skills if you're going to be well regulated. Well regulated meaning like well trained, well versed, effective for conceal carry. First off, you need to possess solid firearm safety. You need good handgun fundamentals, and those are a lot easier said than acquired. I don't know if Wyatt Earp actually said it, but commonly attributed to Wyatt Earp, speed is fine, but accuracy is final. I like to put it a different way. If you can't shoot good slow, then you're not going to shoot good fast. Period. This is not how that works. So you need to possess the fundamentals of handgun shooting. I know it's a handgun, but in Marine Corps boot camp, we had to learn the Rifleman's Creed. One of, if not, I think the most important line in the Rifleman's Creed is, it's the hits that count. It's not as important what caliber you carry, how many rounds you carry, what cool Cerakote job you have on your handgun. If you can't hit your target, none of that really matters. You need to be able to get hits. And until you can get hits slow, don't worry about trying to get hits fast. Basic handgun fundamentals. I think a reasonable goal is to be able to hit a silhouette target like a B-27 or similar at 25 yards. And before you go crazy, I know a lot of handgun shootings are closer than that. Some are farther than that. We're talking about slow fire. You're not moving. The target's not moving. You haven't just been shot. You're using both hands. You should be able to get hits on a man-sized silhouette target at 25 meters or 25 yards. I'm not saying you should stop there. I'm not saying you should be happy with that. But that's a decent level of proficiency. Now that you have a basic degree of handgun fundamentals, start applying those in more practical scenarios. Now, for these other drills, you might bring the target in closer. I would encourage you to do it at varying distances, varying yard lines. The speed you can go at 3 yards is not the speed you can go at 15 yards. Going back to that speed is fine thing. Start working on your ready positions. Your low ready, compressed ready, there are other ready positions, but work on those two. Work on getting that gun out and getting hits on target. That's a part of your draw anyway, so work on those ready positions. Work at getting a hit on target and then get multiple hits on target. Some drills with 2 rounds, some with 3, some with 4. care what caliber you carry, it is not uncommon to need multiple hits to stop an adversary to change his behavior from doing something really, really bad to not doing it anymore. It will often take multiple hits, whatever caliber you have. So practice getting that gun out and getting multiple hits on target. Now, the draw. You could be the most accurate handgun shooter in the world. If you can't get that gun from where you normally have it on you to inaction, that accuracy is only theoretical if you can't get it into the equation in the time of that scenario, the time of that fight. So you need to work on getting your gun out and getting hits on target. Again, start with one, then multiple hits on target. Then you may want to look at adding movement into the equation, meaning when you draw, move to the left, move to the right. At a very minimum. Why? Because if you're getting shot at, you probably shouldn't just stand there. You might not stand there anyway, and the first time you try and do that should not be when there's hot lead coming in your direction. Practice moving, stepping left, stepping right, stepping backwards, while you're getting your gun out and getting your sights on target and getting a hit. The next one I'm going to mention, just practice multiple targets, more than one target. Practice getting a hit on one target and then transitioning to another target and getting a hit, and then multiples on each target. And, of course, you can build on that. You can shoot on the move. You can work on moving in and out of position, moving to and from cover, working cover and concealment and all those things. But I think those skills are a good basic foundation if you're serious about concealed carry. Again, safety, the fundamentals. Introducing that firearm into the equation quickly enough to have it be relevant from the ready position, from the draw. Be able to do that while you're moving and with multiple targets. I think that's a good basic firm foundation for concealed carry. Just a little add-on here. You might consider, once you're at this point, shooting the FBI qual. Not because it's the best qualification out there. I am an FBI handgun instructor. It is the Federal Bureau of Investigation, not the Federal Bureau of Gunfighters, right? But I say that because there are a lot of different things you need to know to shoot that qual, but also, if you actually do get into shooting, you may have to stand before a jury. Shooting that qual, keeping the target, signing it, having a witness sign it, and keeping that may not be the worst thing in the world, because a lot of people see the FBI as competent with handguns, whether that's true or not. And it's not a shall, just throwing it out there. Thanks, TSP. Thanks, Jack. And have a blessed day.
So the only thing I'll add, and we haven't talked about this for a long time, and that's why I want to add it, I can't overstate the value of going out and getting a good quality gas blowback clone of whatever your preferred gun is that you carry. And then training with that, because you can train with it daily for pennies. And you, since you can train with it daily for pennies, you'll probably train at least semi-weekly. And while a 25-yard shot with one of those that will not have the accuracy of a firearm, it just won't. It's still plenty. If you can't hit a human-sized target at 25 yards, it's your problem, not the guns. Sure, the custom 45 or whatever is going to probably group much tighter at that distance, but you still can. But up to ranges of about 15 yards, the quality gas blowbacks are as accurate as you, and that lets you practice at those distances consistently draw. If you buy the right one, your safety release, everything, decocking levers, all of it, magazine swaps, everything you can practice. If you have a big garage or basement or something like that, you can literally hang up a sheet as a backstop, put a piece of paper in front of it as your target, and it will penetrate that paper, land in that sheet, hit the ground, and you can then take that sheet and dump them in a bottle and fire them all over again. You can't do that with your Glock 9mm, your Smith & Wesson 40, or any or 357 SIG, or any like. You can't do that unless you have a really awesome basement with an actual firing range on it, and then you don't need to worry about what I'm saying. All right, let's talk about something else, something that got left off last week's Monday show, the value of labor. I wanted to talk about this when it was a lot of economic topics in that show, and I realized, like, I was like 80% through it that I'd skipped in the beginning and it wouldn't have worked to fit it in, so I let it go. But I want to talk about something that, you know, you can see it with the liberal lunatics when they say something stupid, like a WNBA basketball player should get paid as much as an NBA basketball player. When the reality is, if the WNBA wasn't given a big giant stipend and millions of dollars every year to keep them in business from the NBA, they wouldn't even be in business. They can't sell enough tickets to bring enough people in to fund themselves, let alone make a profit. Where NBA games sell out, celebrities are there, you know, people, you know, will do all kinds of crazy things to get floor seats or a studio box or anything like. This is just not the case with the WNBA. But that's not what this is about. I'm just using that as, that's a thing that most people who don't think like complete morons can get their head around. Of course you don't get paid as much as, and here's another thing, like I don't even follow basketball, okay, at all anymore. But, I, you know, there's stars. There's starting forwards, starting point guards, etc., who are not only just starters for their team, but their team is the top of the league. That person's going to be paid more than a second-string backup for a team that doesn't make the playoffs ever. Right? Even within the same realm, people are paid based on their skill set and their draw in that space. But this is not something that is unique to the NFL or the NBA or sports or women and men or anything, and the gender pay gap bullshit is all bullshit. Before you can even compare labor rates between individuals, they have to be in a like-kind performance, okay? So if you say men make more money than women and that's the gender pay gap, there's a whole shitload of jobs that men do that there's no reason a woman can't do it, but they generally don't want to. You're not going to find many women putting on a helmet with a light on it and going into a coal mine. There's a few, but there ain't many. Well, that actually pays really good. You're not going to find many women on an oil rig in West Texas roughnecking. Well, that pays really good. Okay, you see, like there's a lot of jobs that are not college jobs that pay really good. And there's a lot of women in really high-paying jobs that went to college, and there's a lot of women in really low-paying jobs that went to college, just like there are guys. But there's a lot of women who never go to college or don't graduate, and many of the jobs that pay better are walled off from women without a degree because they won't do the work. They don't want to do it. You know, if you keep going down that road, let's go back to the oil fields. A person who has a truck and a trailer and 6 months of experience that can weld and weld well can go out to the oil fields right now if they have their own equipment, and they can make at least $80,000 a year and very quickly can get up into the middle hundreds. That's another example. Now, how many women are going to do that? So you already have declared, when you've said this gender pay gap, you're already outside of that world. So what you would have to do then is you would have to drill that down and look at like kind. Two personnel that work for similar companies at the middle management level and a office oversight environment that have about the same amount of people work for them. And if you do that, you know what you'll find? That because of all this DEI bullshit that they've done and diversity shit they've done, in general, women are actually in like-kind work, if it's true like-kind work, actually are earning more than men. Now, I'm not here to have a grievance about that. I'm just telling you that's the case. But when you really want to look at, and most of the people that scream the loudest about this gender pay gap, they don't make shit anyway. They're poorly paid, and that's why they're easily influenced by this idea that it's unfair how much you're paid. And one of the real things that people struggle with, and this is why communism fails, because communism's all about, it's the value of the labor. The labor is the value, right? You work in a factory, and you work on an assembly line, and you work all day, every day. And the CEO, he might only come to that factory once a week. and he's off doing all kinds. He's playing golf. He's flying around on a jet, et cetera. Well, here's the first of all. How did he become the CEO? Did somebody just one day pick out the phone book and just throw it on the floor and then throw a dart at it, and the name that it landed on, they said he was the CEO? He had to do something to be the CEO. And in most instances, it probably means he was a founder or co-founder of the organization he's now leading. Did you do that? No. Okay. So you're already out of the like kind. But it gets worse for the person, and it could be a lot of different jobs. It could be a janitor at a school. It could be a person that picks oranges off a tree. It could be anything in that lower level labor market. You are not going to ever make a lot of money doing that. And the reason you're never going to make a lot of money doing that, unless you come up with something really creative and create your own thing doing it, right, is because you are expendable. You are replaceable. You are a part. You are commoditized. The closer whatever you do is to a commoditized product, then the lower your wage will be for all eternity relative to everybody else's. How do you know you're in that realm? Well, if I hired somebody that was regionally intelligent, let's say somebody with like a 100 IQ average, median IQ for the United States is 98, by the way. So if I hired somebody that was reasonably intelligent and knew how to show up on time, and I had to train them to do your job, how long would it take me to train them to do your job? If the answer is 2 weeks or less, you are definitely a commodity. Even 30 days, you are a commodity. Especially if that person does not have to have any specific prior experience. You know, that person could have been the other day driving a truck to the dump and back every day, and the city downsized, he lost his job, and now he wants to go work in a warehouse loading and unloading boxes. When he was a garbage man, all he did was drive the truck. He never touched anything. He drove the truck, he hit a button, and it dumped. Okay? He has no real relevant experience to your job. He can still learn your job in probably a day. He'll probably be good at it in a week, and he'll probably be as good as anybody else would be in two. Your job's a commodity. As your employer, I'm not going to pay you a high wage to do that work because I have a line of people waiting to take your job if you don't show up for work. And then you can just apply that and figure out what level you're on. Now, that means that if you do something and you quit tomorrow, and your company would be in a bad way, and it would be very hard to replace you, and you are low paid, you have, unless this company's not making money and they simply don't have it to pay you, you have the ability to negotiate a higher wage, I guarantee you. Because trying to replace you, if that's... But we have a big time ability to oversell ourselves to ourselves, to think that's true when it's not. Most people, if you didn't go to work tomorrow, it might be crazy for a week or two, but if in a week or two everything could be taken care of, you're still in a commodity level position. Now, I said we'd talk about guilds, and I want to point out how guilding can artificially raise the cost of labor, and this is why we have guilds. This is why we have unions. This is why we have a lot of like third-party certifications or even government certifications that were lobbied on by the people in the private sector to create a government certification, regulate us harder, daddy, to guild the thing. And the best way I can explain this is not with labor. In Texas, if you want to sell fireworks, you can only sell them two times a year, around the 4th and around New Year's. That's it. And you have to have a special permit. Now, a guy that lives across the road from me has a partnership with a dude that I buy my meat from like a half mile, three-quarter mile down the road. He has the certification to sell fireworks, and that dude down the road that does the cows basically leases him the space because it's a much better location. It's a lot of room. He's got a big open area for people to pull in and park and lots of trees for shade in the summer and all that. So they have a partnership. Now, there's been some movement to try to liberalize, in the best possible way of using that word, the permits for fireworks in Texas. In other words, if these people can do it, why are we limiting how many people can do this? Well, of course, my neighbor, nice guy, totally opposed to it. Now, you would think a guy that sells fireworks would be for the legalization of fireworks. No, no, no. He has a permit.
within easy drive from my house, there's only one other place that gets a permit and sells fireworks that competes with him. Why would he want this liberalized and have more to compete with? So there's so many places where there's a certification or a requirement or something like that. All that is artificially inflating the value of the labor. So you have to have this certification from a third-party entity, plus you have to have this certification from the government. Or you have to have this certification, plus you have to be bonded to do this job. Those are generally driven by, one, it does give me something to sell. If you're bonded, that means if you screw something up, there's money to cover it. So I can tell my customers that my employees are bonded. But if there's a, instead of me choosing to do it as a business owner, if this is done in mass for a specific type of job, what it does is limit the number of people that can compete for that job, regardless of how hard it is to train them. This is where all the value of labor either comes from or is manipulated. And then the other side is, what is the demand on the other side of that labor? That's where we can go back to the NBA and the WNBA. Let's say that the women in the WNBA were actually better than they are, that they were almost as good as the guys, that they could actually, like the WNBA championship team could play the high school male championship team for the country and win, which they can't. They would get beat by any, let's say, five or six, say, male basketball team would beat the champions of the WNBA. I'm sorry, they would, let alone college. Now, if you went to the national championship college basketball team and played the NBA champions for the same year, you know what's going to happen. They're going to get killed. Where it's the exact opposite. But let's say it wasn't, that they're even better. Let's say that by some weird freak, women were actually better at basketball than men, and they actually could beat the male team. But let's say that people just didn't care. And the viewership and the attendance of the games and the sponsorship and all of it was the same as it is now on both sides. It wouldn't matter that one side's better. Because one side has massive demand and the other side has no real demand. And I'm sorry, they don't. If you're a fan, great, I'm happy for you. But the demand in total dollars isn't there. So you can be exceptional at something. You can be the only person in the world that can do it. Maybe you can crap a turd that looks like Snoopy the dog. I don't know. But if nobody wants it, it still has no value. So your value of labor, the reason I'm bringing this up is if you're going to negotiate, you need to understand this. And if you're going to hire people, you need to understand this. Your value of labor is multiple. It's, you know, how many people want the job you have? And if a lot of people want it, then not in of itself, because a lot of people want, you know, to be a Ferrari salesman, but not everybody can do it. But if a lot of people want it and a lot of people can do it, then your value to an employer just immediately drops. If a lot of people want it, but very few people can do it, you probably are a very high value employee, because that means there's prestige with it, but even with that prestige, there's not many qualified applicants. But the big thing is, what's the demand on the other side? And that demand is not just like the industry demand, right? Just because the industry is like a $1,900 billion industry or whatever, doesn't mean it. What is the demand on the other side for the company you're going to work for? When you work for a smaller company, you may get paid less simply because they don't have the money. Now, there's a beauty in this. Often you can, if you are extremely skilled with those smaller companies, negotiate some sort of incentive-based compensation where they can pay you much better because they only pay it to you when you bring them or build their business in some way. But at the other side, you are now getting the experience for the company that had to settle for you. Okay? They had to settle for you because they couldn't afford somebody that checked all the boxes to be in this marketing or sales or project management position or something that actually had a direct impact on revenue. But you couldn't get the better job that paid better because you didn't have the experience, so you were gilded out. So the ninjutsu, right, instead of status ninjutsu, the corporate ninjutsu is you find the company that has a requirement for the position you want that can't afford the person that actually has the street cred to do it, and they're willing to take a shot at it for you. And then you build that, and you build it to a point where you do exactly what I did. This is how I advanced in my career without college. You get to the point where, like, look, guys, I've doubled your business. I want better terms. No. Okay, I'll go do it for somebody else. and I'll get better terms in that movement. But that's how the value of labor actually works. It's a function of demand on the other side, supply on this side, and how unique you are in your position. This is another good evaluation for you to decide, do you want a side hustle? Do you want to start working on your own business? Do you want to start working on more skill sets, develop more ability to penetrate guilds? Because if you are a person who can be replaced in a week, and I have to lay people off, and there's anything I don't like about you at all, I'm getting rid of you. I will use it, even if I don't need to lay off, you know, let's say 20 people at your level of labor, I could get by with 15, but there's something about you or your performance, your person, anything about you I don't like, and I can always hire someone back if I change my mind, you're gone. This, again, is why unions exist, because employers do this, and the worker sees it as unfair. Personally, I wouldn't run a business in a state that wasn't a right-to-work state. Texas is a right-to-work state. The unions that do exist here are incredibly weak. You almost have to have the employer agree to it in total for it to have any impact at all. And if you're non-union in this state and you have an employee, and I don't like the way you brushed your hair today, I can fire you and there's nothing you can do about it. Now, if we have a contractual employment thing, then the contract is the Bible. And then the other thing with that is it doesn't generally happen anyway, because as an employer, I have to pay workman's comp insurance. And if I have a habit of kicking people to the curb really fast, especially once they've been there long enough to qualify, my cost of that insurance is going to go way up, and I have to have that insurance on you as an employee, if that all makes sense, right? So there are some safeguards of that. But in general, that's how this all works. And you should put yourself to this test. The next time you think, I don't get paid enough, how hard would you be to replace? How many people are there? And, you know, you can look inside even certain industries and see that very subtle differences have a big impact on the supply-demand curve. If you have a pilot's license to fly rotor wing, which is helicopters, there's a lot less competition in that industry, because the number of people that have certification and new people with certification added to the pool for fixed wing is much higher. Medical assistant, dental assistant. I wouldn't want to spend all my days with my hands in somebody's mouth like a dental assistant might, but a dental assistant really ain't going to make a lot more money, but have a lot quicker path to a job, because there's so many medical assistants that graduate every 6 months versus dental assistants. Hygienist is going to make more money because it's a longer path and it's more specialized, and again, there's less competition. But I recently had this discussion on Facebook, which is what spawned today's episode, and somebody said, but it is a gender pay gap, because most dentists are men, and dentists make more than a hygienist, and the hygienist does more work. The dentist is a fucking doctor. The dentist went to fucking medical school. The dentist went to school for 8 years and then had to intern and resident under somebody else, and if you want to make dentist money, you have to do dentist shit. And by the way, there's plenty of female dentists, and there's plenty of male hygienists. There's definitely more of one than the other, and vice versa, but the pathway's there. In every place that you become more difficult to replace, the skill set and the qualification level goes up, the potential earnings goes up. And for everything you don't have, the potential earnings goes down. And adding something when your employer doesn't care doesn't help you. So within the data cable world, which I was part of for a while, there were all the manufacturers had these different certifications. You know, Lucent certified, you know, Burtec Ortronics certified, Nortel certified, etc. All, and they're all good. And then Bixie certification, Bixie certified technician. I was a Bixie certified RCDD and OSP and LAN specialist, right? That mattered if the company cared. If the company could sell that credential to a customer. Without that, it doesn't. You have a bunch of initials after your name, that's nice, here's $15 an hour, fuck off. It's just how it works. So if you're going to start adding like credentials, if you're going to start adding certifications, and you're doing it specifically not to expand your skill set in itself, but to expand your value, make sure that you're matching those things up. Anyway, with that, I'll go ahead and wrap up. Again, I want to remind you, Laws of Life is coming out. If you liked my segment today, you'll probably really like Laws of Life. And if you think, man, I know this person that could use a kick in the rear or some guides, or this person's really charging already, but you know they need a little bit more, That'd be a great gift, too. Again, Laws of Life is the book. And go by the site, thesurvivalpodcast.com. Fill out the form. You'll get an email the day before and the day that it launches. Again, the ambassador positions are full. But, hey, if you want to buy one and give one, that would still be a great way to help me out, and I'd appreciate it. With that, take care. I'll catch you tomorrow with that flashback, which is already done, so I know it'll happen. And I'll be back on Monday with a brand-new episode.
They said you should have a house. The American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.